Another busy week in politics. Joining us today to talk about the policy and personalities of U.S. politics is NPR's political junkie, Ken Rudin. Welcome to the show, Ken.
Good morning, Ann.
Let's just kick it off with Michelle Bachmann, the U.S. representative from Minnesota. She's announced her plans to run for president in 2012 in New Hampshire. She bragged about her anti-establishment credentials that make her the perfect Republican package.
In my wallet, there's no card that says Good Old Boys Club. I take on the opposition party, but I take on my own party as well, because I believe it is principle over party. That's what comes first.
So, Ken, those interviewed by NPR for that show, for that story, after that New Hampshire speech said they found her polished and captivating. How is she faring now and might in the future?
The future is another story, but right now she seems to be the flavor of the month. She of course, got great reviews in her debate in New Hampshire on June 13th, where she was sure of herself and combative and yet smiling. And, a lot of the people are focusing on the gaffes she's made, and she's made a bunch of gaffes, and she's going to have to work on that. But right now the Republicans are looking for a fighter. And I think a lot of Republicans are looking for an alternative to Mitt Romney, who seems to be the nominal front runner, given the fact that he's raising so much money and he seems to be leading in many polls, even though this is still the end of June 2011. We've got a long way to go before we reach the first caucus. But right now, she seems to be captivating a lot of people, and people are paying attention to her.
Let's go back to the issue, though, that we always return to, is she could make it at this point. It looks like she could make it in a primary, but what about a general election?
Well, we don't even know if she can make a primary. She could do well in Iowa. She declared her candidacy in Waterloo, Iowa, where she's born. She has strong support there. She is strong with the religious and social conservatives, and also Tea Party conservatives. She is the head of the Tea Party caucus in the House. But in states like New Hampshire, which is more economic conservative, more independents can vote. The question remains whether she can win over these independents, who, if any Republican is going to beat President Obama in November 2012, they're going to have to win over the independents. And the question remains: if somebody as conservative as Bachmann is, can she curry favor with those independents? That still remains to be seen.
She echoed not an uncommon refrain among conservative Republicans that Obama's a one-term president, but he was in Iowa. Is that earlier than usual?
Well, it was ostensibly for a business speech. Clearly, everybody who knows anything that's going on, you don't go to Iowa to give a business speech, especially if you're the president of the United States, and Iowa being Iowa. The point is, everybody is running around in Iowa, meaning all these Republican candidates, trashing the president, trashing his record. And so I guess the president felt that let me have some counterbalance in the state. It's not about the caucuses. No Democrat of any stature is going to challenge Obama for renomination. But Iowa is another four-letter word.
Oh, we're all the same, aren't we, Ken?
Iowa is still, a swing state. It's closely watched, and the president was there, trying to make his case as well.
My guest is Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie. If you have a question or comment for Ken, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Let's talk about the money race. NPR's Peter Overby assessed the finances of candidates this week. He found that besides Mitt Romney, few of the other Republican candidates have been able to drum up much money. The second quarter Federal Election Commission finance reports are due in about 2 weeks.
As yet, none of the other Republicans have signaled dramatic strength in fundraising. Just last week, former Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty was explaining why some of his top aides aren't being paid. And on former House Speaker Newt Gingrich's campaign, two top fundraisers quit.
Gosh, that reminds me, there's Newt Gingrich to talk about, too. But what do you make of the money at this point?
Well, it can be overrated and overstated. We know that going back to 1996, way back in the 1996, which of course was yesterday for some of us. But anyway, Phil Gramm was raising an unbelievable amount of money and, was gone shortly after the New Hampshire primary. So you can raise a lot of money and not make a difference. But then we also saw with George W. Bush in 2000, who broke all those records and was raising tons of money and did get the nomination. It is, people are just fascinated by Romney's ability to raise a lot of money. Of course, having run for president before is a big plus. But also people are going to watch people like, you know, Tim Pawlenty, the former governor of Minnesota, who's been spending a lot of time in Iowa trying to raise money, trying to build a staff. And if he gets only maybe, you know, if his numbers show only $3-5 million, that's a lot of money for some of us. But for somebody who's been raising money or who's been trying to raise money for so long, trying to make a difference in the polls, he is not doing the job he needs to do.
And if it's not looking good, then that usually slows down whatever money might have trickled in.
Well, it does, because you'll get a lot of unsatisfying and unsatisfactory newspaper headlines saying worse than expected. Just like on August 13th, you're going to have the Ames straw poll, which ultimately is just shows how you can organize 6-8 months in advance. But when people don't do well in the Ames straw poll, the headlines show big defeat. Dan Quayle, Lamar Alexander and a lot of other candidates have dropped out because they didn't do well in the Ames straw poll. So we always talk about the delegates and always talk about the caucuses and the primaries, but ultimately there are a lot of things that go on before the people have a chance to vote, and the money game is part of that.
And it has a lot to do with the headlines that emerge after that.
That's exactly right. I mean, and perception is reality in politics, and so if the headline says worse than expected, more disappointing, that just stays with you. The headlines that Newt Gingrich got when his staff left, when his fundraisers left, were devastating. And, you know, you could talk about all the ideas in the world he has. I don't know how you recover from that.
So does he?
No, he does not. He doesn't. He still thinks that the way to win the nomination is to write books and to espouse ideas. And his previous staff said, no, you gotta organize. You gotta get on the ground in Iowa. You gotta just sign up the local talent. And Gingrich, who's never run for office anywhere outside of his suburban Atlanta congressional district, and who hasn't run for anything since 1998, it's a new landscape. And I suspect he's not long for this race.
Well, yeah, but he was Speaker of the House, and he wasn't born yesterday, and even though he hasn't run since 1998, it hasn't changed that much. How do you explain his kind of attitude toward this?
Well, I mean, he was always, first of all, I think that the terrain has changed a lot since 1998. As a matter of fact, I think it's changed a lot since 2008. In 2008, remember, the Republican Party was on the defensive. The GOP was a four-letter word, not a three-letter word, and look what happened in 2010. So I think the Republican Party is far more conservative, far more distrusting of government than they were in 2008. The thought of George W. Bush campaigning as a compassionate conservative in 2000, you don't hear the word compassionate that much on the Republican side. The Republican Party is angry. They're angry at just what they feel is the overreach by the government, that the spending and all that stuff, so there's anger out there. And Gingrich, while he was great in the minority, he was a great bomb thrower, once he became Speaker, he was petulant, he was petty. Remember the fact when he sat in the back of the airplane when he came back on Air Force One from Rabin's funeral in Israel?
Right.
He was complaining about that. I mean, he just rubbed a lot of Republicans the wrong way, and I never saw a groundswell for a Gingrich presidential candidacy.
And compared to John Boehner, or how does John Boehner stack up to a Newt Gingrich?
Well, Boehner, I think, learned a lot of the lessons that hurt Gingrich in the fact that he was so imperial. But also Boehner is very interesting in the fact that, back then Republicans seemed to be on the same page. They seemed to be, not that there was only one wing of the Republican Party, but here the Republicans do vote in together in the House, but there is an eat their own kind of feeling among Tea Party folks. Like, I think one of the reasons why you just cannot have taxes on the table, even though President Obama's news conference yesterday talked about that so important, how important that was, because if you're a Republican and you say, okay, well, we'll support tax increases, the Tea Party will be unforgiving, absolutely unforgiving in 2012. We saw what happened to George H.W. Bush in 1992 when he reversed his Read My Lips, No New Taxes, and he changed his mind on taxes. A lot of conservatives sat home. it would be much, much uglier, I think, for the Republicans in 2012 if they violate that pledge.
All right. Well, let's hear from the press conference yesterday, for that matter. President Obama called on Washington lawmakers to stop playing games with the federal deficit and the decision to raise the or not to raise the debt ceiling. Let's hear what he had to say.
This is a matter of Congress going ahead and biting the bullet and making some tough decisions, because we know what the decisions are. We've identified what spending cuts are possible. We've identified what defense cuts are possible. We've identified what health care cuts are possible. We've identified what loopholes in the tax code can be closed that would also raise revenue. We've identified what the options are. And the question now is, are we going to step up and get this done?
Okay, was there anything new in that?
The only thing I thought was new was that the president seemed more combative than usual. Usually he takes both parties to task. He's equally dismissive or equally critical of Democrats and Republicans. This time he seemed to be clearly not too happy with Republicans and what they feel is their unwillingness to compromise on taxes. And, you know, it's not that the Republicans not that he's saying that we should raise taxes. He's saying let's just eliminate some of the loopholes. How could you be against the billions and billions of tax breaks that the oil and gas industry gets? How could you? And then he talked about the people with the luxury yachts. It reminded me of the opposite of Ronald Reagan when he used to talk about welfare queens. I mean, this was Obama's example of welfare queens. This was the luxury yacht owners who were just he's obviously trying to pull a populist. A populist attempt to not so much class warfare, but to make a point saying, look, everybody else is suffering. Education is suffering. Infrastructure is suffering. And how could you allow, one way of bridging this gap, no pun intended because of the infrastructure, but one way of, eliminating this gap or closing the gap is by just making it fair and just by taking away some of these tax breaks.
So even the idea of closing loopholes is being translated into a tax increase.
That's what the Republicans are saying. It still remains to be seen. I'm still not convinced there will not be some change. You can't just do it, as far as I understand, you can't just do it on cut spending. But then you have Kent Conrad, the chairman of the Senate Budget Committee, who just, the other day said, we're not proposing enough cuts. It should be far more than what we're doing. So he almost put the Democrats in a bind as well. But if the Democrats are talking about more and more cuts, like $3 trillion in cuts, then if we're talking about a compromise, if we're talking about something to agree on, then the argument goes the Republicans have to concede something too. And to just say that, no, we just have to cut spending, there's no compromise there at all. And it'll be very interesting to see how they arrive at this, at this agreement, especially with this August 2nd deficit, the debt ceiling limit approaching.
We're talking with Ken Rudin. He's NPR's political junkie. Questions or comments for Ken, 614-292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
WOSU Public Media's fiscal year ends today. If you have made a pledge to 89.7 NPR News, please be sure to fulfill your gift. Send in your contribution using your return envelope or call our membership department at 614-292-9678. Remember, you've got the power to strengthen and support 89.7 NPR News. Thank you for participating in WOSU Public Media's fiscal year-end fundraiser.
Support for the Statehouse News Bureau stories on 89.7 come from the law firm of Porter, Wright, Morris, and Arthur LLP, helping businesses and individuals solve complex legal problems throughout Ohio, across the country, and around the world. On the web at porterwright.com.
77 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunny skies today, and a nice day with a high of 84. Clear skies tonight, a low of 59 degrees. More sunshine for Friday, a high of 87. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We're talking with Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie. 614-292-8513. That's the number to call if you have a question or comment for Ken. Speaking of the president's press conference, Time Magazine's Mark Halperin made a disparaging remark about the president on Joe Scarborough's show yesterday, and someone didn't know how to use the delay button. And I can sympathize with that. But what was Halpern talking about? That he's something to the effect that the president was grumpier than usual, or what?
Well, I just saw the headlines of it. But of course, here we are talking about headlines again. But what's interesting about this, Halpern called the president a four-letter word, not the F word, but an equally disparaging word that you don't expect from Mark Halpern, because if anybody who read his book Game Change, he seemed to call everybody this four-letter word except for President Obama, because he seemed to be completely smitten with him. So I think, you know, there are a lot of progressives, there are a lot of folks who just feel that Obama could have been stronger, you know, less cute on Libya, could have been stronger on same-sex marriage, and he's certainly not been strong at all about same-sex marriage. Mm-hmm. So I don't really know exactly what was in Mark Halpern's head, but it just seemed kind of odd because he trashed Elizabeth Edwards, he trashed Hillary Clinton, he trashed the Clintons, the Edwardses, everybody else except Barack Obama. So now he's an equal opportunity trasher. But, you know, sometimes, and I mean, look, we're all guilty of this. We all think that what we have to say is so monumental and so important. But then you throw in your own, you know, trying to your own point of view or your own, you know, unhappiness or resentments, and it just comes back to bite you. And you know, I think that's one of a lot of reasons. And I'm sure I'm as guilty of this as anything else. Although I've never called anybody a word like this, but at the same time, I think one of the reasons people just have such a low standing of journalists is that you replace analysts and reporting with commentary and opinion. And that's not, as far as I know, that's not what journalism is all about.
We have an email from Sarah. She writes, Ken, weren't you in Aspen yesterday with Talk of the Nation for the Ideas Festival? She says, I love the political junkie segment on Wednesday. I never miss it. I have tried to win the trivia question a couple of times. I want to win the no prize and be on the wall of shame. Where is the wall of shame anyway?
Well, two things, Sarah. Sarah is very important. First of all, no, I wasn't in Aspen. They usually, when the Talk of the Nation travels, they take me with them, but they left me behind in Washington, and they went to Aspen. My picture was on the wall there, which is just as good as, because, you know, I have a very good face for radio. But Sarah, I think Sarah should know that I should never tell people this out loud, but if you send me cash, I will give you the answer to the trivia question in advance, and then you could win the T-shirt. I mean, that's how it's done. That's really how it's done on Talk of the Nation. A lot of people don't know that, but Ann, I like your show a lot, and I think your listeners should know that's how it works.
Well, I've hesitated to enter it myself because I thought you would favor me.
Yeah, right.
Hey, and by the way, speaking of your picture, it's like poster size on our website right now. If anybody wants to go to WOSU.org/allsides, you got
scary.
A big fat picture.
But the wall is here. So anyway, every Talk of the Nation on Wednesday, the Political Junkies segment, I start with a trivia question. And as a matter of fact, when I was out at WOSU not too long ago, with the studio audience, we had an Ohio trivia question. But anyway, so the first person with a correct answer wins a Political Junkie T-shirt. And so and then Neil Conan has everybody send in a picture of them wearing the T-shirt for the Wall of Shame.
Okay.
Yeah.
And where is that?
It's somewhere on. If you go to NPR.org,
okay.
And go to the Talk of the Nation site, you'll see it there.
Okay. It's on the website.
By the way, unfortunately, there were no Anthony Weiner pictures. I don't know why that's happened, but I think they were all deleted.
Are you in the mood to talk about Anthony Weiner?
No.
Okay.
No. I think that it's amazing. That's all we could talk about for the longest time. And now, you know, he's gone and he saved the Democrats from a ton of embarrassment. And now nobody's talking about him, which is a shame for people like us.
Phil in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi, Phil.
Mr. Rudin, I've seen your picture on the website.
I'm frankly
envious because I tried to get a job in broadcasting and was told that I was too ugly to work in radio. But what I called the comment about was the rhetorical discipline in the Republican Party. You will never hear them use the phrase raise taxes on the rich. They will say raise taxes on any American. Or they will never speak about large corporations. It's always small businesses. I sometimes wonder if you heard a Republican use the phrase the rich, it would be a signal that the end of days is approaching. And I'll take my comment off the air.
Well, Phil, that's an interesting question. I mean, there is, you know, there are, just like Democrats don't like to use the word liberal anymore, they say progressive. There are code words out there that, you know, that mean, you know, you're trying to appeal to the base. That's true. You don't talk about corporations. You talk about small business. And while a lot of the policies that help small businesses certainly help large corporations, but that's a very interesting point that these, you know, there are ways, there are different ways different groups can use certain language to suit their needs, and you just supplied a whole bunch of good examples of it.
Thanks, Phil, for that comment. What about the idea of rhetorical discipline? Are the Republicans better at it than the Democrats, or vice versa? What do you think?
Well, discipline is a tough word. You know, when you hear candidates talking about, you know, like I think Newt Gingrich called Obama a food stamp president. I mean, that conjures up a whole bunch of things that I think are unfortunate. You know, there's so much to criticize with the Obama record, and you could do that very effectively without coming to things like that. And you know, there's always, you know, subtle things about, you know, where he was born and whether he's a Muslim, and you know, you don't hear that as much, but you heard that a lot from Donald Trump. Another name that we don't mention anymore for that thing.
I didn't bring it up.
No. Well, I do know you were on the Trump bandwagon. That's true.
Who's just egging you?
No. But I'm just saying that there is, you know. But here's the thing: when John Huntsman, the former governor of Utah, announced a week or so ago his candidacy, he said he believes in civility. That while he wants to criticize the Obama record, he wants it to be civil. It's not going to be civil, and I'm not just blaming Republicans, but you know, the Democrats were not civil when they went after Bush in 2004, you know, and the Republicans in 2008. There's a lot of anger out there. There's a lot of just disappointing policies, and people, especially the people who, you know, are on the outs, are just angry. And I think there's more and more anger. We saw tons of anger with Bill Clinton. We saw tons of anger increasing with George W. Bush. And we see tons more with Obama. And God knows what's going to be in future generations. But it's not encouraging.
Did you find Bristol Palin encouraging when she was teasing the world with hints about whether her mother, she says she's made her decision, her mother, Sarah Palin, has made her decision, but she just has decided not to tell anybody yet.
Right, and Sarah Palin apparently sent her daughter Bristol an email saying, look, you know, what's said on the fishing boat stays on the fishing boat, you know, the old Vegas quote. But look, I'm a little tired of the Palin tease. What I like about the other candidates is that, you know, if they're running for president, they're running for president. And Sarah Palin has done nothing to run. She has not talked to any fundraiser folks. She's not talked to any big-name Republicans. She's not talked to county chairman. She everything we hear about her is Twitter and Facebook and sometimes Fox News. And I'm not – look, my problem with Sarah Palin is not that she's a conservative. I mean, I still remember when she was picked as VP at the convention in 2008, and I thought that's exactly the shot in the arm the Republican Party needed. They were not so excited about McCain. I thought she gave the party a bunch of adrenaline that was sorely needed. But, you know, it turned out that, especially since the election, she's petulant, she's resentful, she's everybody's out to get her. She's, you know, the lamestream media. I mean, you know, that's a cute line for Fox News, but come on, I mean, Michelle Bachmann, Rick Santorum, the other folks are very, very conservative too, but they don't spend all their time whining about the media. Look, if you're a conservative and you believe the media are out to get you, nothing will change. You either live with it or you don't. Sarah Palin seems unwilling to live with it. Other candidates seem to be willing to live with it. And was she treated harshly and sometimes unfairly in 2008? I think yes. I think some of the comments about her children, her children's children, were just way over the top and just ugly. But at the same time, is she a serious candidate? What is, you know, she takes a bus tour up and she makes these, you know, these unspecific comments about leadership and patriotism, and I can't imagine that's going to be the basis for a presidential candidacy.
Although someone
let me tell you how I really feel.
Okay, well, you know, we had some history professors on about that time, and one of them noted that, gosh, it was a great day for, you know, history lessons when Sarah Palin was in New Hampshire.
Well,
she got everybody talking about history.
Well, she—I mean, she talked about Paul Revere,
right.
And you know, she was not that the British were coming, but she—he was to warn that he was warning the British not to, you know, take our arms away. I mean, I don't know what, you know, the heck that means. But look, you know, I don't know. The weird thing is that once she says something like that, and then all her supporters went to Wikipedia to try to edit the history to make it go in line with what she said, which is just so. Well, one reason why you should never look at Wikipedia, but another reason why it's just so nuts out there. But look, a lot of mistakes are being made, but she's just not specific. She's just, you know, she's a still, oh gosh, and, you know, I'm honored, and it's a big decision. But, you know, any time you turn on Fox and you listen to the Brit Humes and the O'Reillys and the Hannitys of the world, they all, to a person, feel that she's not going to run. And I kind of agree with them. I don't think she's running because she's certainly. If she runs, nobody's ever done something like this before, because it would basically be on her own with just a handful of people close to her, especially her husband, Todd. And, you know, maybe that worked in the 1800s, but it's not going to work in this century. Absolutely not.
You know, folks aren't talking about Sarah Palin in Ohio right now. They're talking about Senate Bill 5 and record-breaking 1.3 million signatures were gathered to place that back on the November ballot for repeal. It's the new law that would ban collective bargaining for public employees. We have a message from Terry on Facebook about that. She says, so I rearranged my schedule so I can listen to Ken. Thank you, Terry, for that. What are his thoughts on the repeal of Senate Bill 5 here in Ohio? Has it invigorated the people who stayed home in 2010 and did not vote?
Well, I think it absolutely has. I think that just as President Obama and health care has invigorated Republicans in 2010 and led to new, you know, Republican governors in Ohio, in Wisconsin, in Michigan, in Pennsylvania, in Florida. At the same time, some of this overreach, you know, the taking on the unions, the cutting back the public employees' rights and bargaining rights, that seems to have invigorated Democrats. Now, we saw that in Wisconsin recently, with an election for this Supreme Court judge, the incumbent Republican, well, it's a nonpartisan job, but the incumbent conservative was supposed to have a huge lead. He barely won. He won on a recount because a lot of Democrats were energized. And to see the number of signatures that were put through for the SB 5 bill to get it on the ballot in November is just, you know, far more than needed and far more than anybody expected. Now, of course, you know, the other side could be equally motivated and they could vote. They could still, you know, defeat, you know, win their case in November. But clearly the Democrats who would seem to be disoriented, disorganized, disenchanted in November of 2010, they seem to be more organized and ready for a fight in 2011. The question is whether Obama is ready for the fight. You did see a bit of it in the press conference yesterday.
We've got Glenn from the OSU campus. Welcome to the show, Glenn.
Thank you. Hi. I was just wondering if you can explain who Grover Norquist is and why it seems that so many Republicans are beholden to him and his pledge of never to raise taxes.
Well, you know, it's one of those litmus tests that I guess, you know, whatever the Republicans' views on taxes were, and of course they were always blaming the Democrats for the tax party. George H.W. Bush, switched his views on taxes, agreed in 1990 in the budget deals to increase taxes. The conservatives never let him forget it, for one thing, and two, it almost was the beginning of the Tea Party, saying that, you know, we cannot have these rhinos, these Republicans in name only. We need true economic conservatives who will battle back taxes. Grover Norquist and the Club for Growth and his group, the anti-tax groups that he, you know, and he for, you know, has them sign, the candidates signing a pledge. He did. It's just been, you know, one of those. It's the way communism used to be with the Republican Party when there was a communist threat out there. You know, you could never be soft on communism. Yeah, now you cannot be soft on taxes. You can't be soft on abortion. And Norquist knows that. I mean, he just knows how to touch the right buttons and had to get a lot of conservatives, energized. So you have conservative, in my mind, moderate conservative Republicans like Dick Lugar of Indiana and Orrin Hatch of Utah, who were in big trouble because they're soft on these kind of issues because the Tea Party is so energized. So, you know, you talk taxes to your own peril.
Thanks, Glenn, for that call. Let's talk about the New York gay marriage legislation that passed on Friday. It's been nearly a week, actually, since it became the second largest state in the nation to legalize same-sex marriage, as was reported by NPR on Morning Edition.
On Friday, New York became the largest state in the nation to legalize gay marriage. Lindsay Catt was one of the thousands celebrating the news.
I feel a huge sense of joy, although I must say there is a resounding feeling of we've won the battle, but now need to continue working to win the war.
Indeed, those celebrating and those who are not are trying to sort out just how the battle in New York will affect that larger war.
The president has lauded the news, Ken, but he stopped short of endorsing gay marriage. The Wall Street Journal's Laura Meckler, former Ohio State House reporter, by the way, tried to pry more from him yesterday during that press conference, but he wasn't having any of it. What's his deal?
Well, remember, he campaigned. I mean, we always talk about Mitt Romney's flip-flops. He campaigned President Obama as an opponent of same-sex marriage. He said he believed marriage is between a man and a woman, and that's, you know, and that's what he feels. He thought that a Christian, that's his philosophy. He has said that his views are evolving. A recent Gallup poll showed that 53% of the country, for the first time in history, in my understanding, now a majority favors same-sex marriage. And, you know, we talk about, you know, something like New York, which was amazing for so many reasons. It was a Republican state Senate that passed it. I mean, only four Republicans voted for it, but it was a Republican legislature that basically passed it. New York is the sixth state, the biggest state by far to have gay marriage. But the important thing also is every time it's been on a ballot, every single time it's been on a ballot before the voters have voted it down. Mm-hmm. 29 states have constitutional amendments prohibiting it. 12 other states have laws opposing it. So you could talk about momentum, and you could talk about, you know, perhaps, you know, a new sense of understanding in the country. And I believe the views of many Americans are evolving, and yet every time it goes before the voters say no.
Do you think it would make a difference if the president came out and said, oh, that came out the wrong way.
Yeah, I know. When you said came out, I was thinking, Henry didn't want to risk the seven-second delay that Mark Halperin violated.
if the president said, I do support it, it should be a national law.
Well, you know something? He's very cautious. And, you know, that's why I was so interested in his approach yesterday, because he was pretty combative. But he still has to win re-election. He's still, you know, a lot of the states that he won in 2008 are not favorable towards him. I mean, he's going to have a tough battle in the Ohios, the Indianas, the Virginias, the North Carolinas, the Floridas. So he knows that. But I don't think he needs to do that. I think he said already that, you know, it's clear that he thought the thing in New York was a good thing. But to me, to hear from him a states' rights approach, like, well, you know, to me, that's what's good about it is that every state should have it, the right to decide how to define marriage. That sounds like the old anti-civil rights stuff of the 50s and 60s, states' rights, that, you know, we don't want any federal law. We want to decide how we feel about race by state. And I'm not equating, you know, opposition to gay marriage, you know, to opposition to civil rights bills, but to talk about states' rights, for so many of the people who were encouraged by Obama in 2008, despite his view on same-sex marriage, he's trying to get rid of the Defense of Marriage Act. He's the Don't Ask, Don't Tell is changing. But do I think he needs to stand up and say, I'm in favor of it? There are a lot of people who would like to hear it. I don't know if politically that would be palatable. And this is a very political president.
My guest, it's Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie. You can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org if you have a question or comment for Ken. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On on the next Fresh Air, Fareed Zakaria, host of the CNN program GPS and editor-at-large for Time magazine. He's revised and expanded his book, The Post-American World. He says it's not about the decline of America, but rather about the rise of everyone else. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon. Join WOSU Public Media for a Chefs in the City coffee brunch at the Elegant Deepwood Restaurant. The event is Saturday, July 23rd, and tickets are on sale now for $45 each. A handcrafted seasonal brunch will be presented by Chefs Brian Pollock and Amber Heron of Deepwood. Guests will also learn to make excellent coffee at home with Andy Luck of Luck Brothers Coffee House. Tickets are limited. Visit WOSU.org/chefs to reserve yours now. Proceeds from this and all Chefs in the City events directly support children's educational programming on WOSU-TV.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Columbus Symphony. The 2011 Picnic with the Pops series celebrates Independence Day with Patriotic Pops this Saturday, July 2nd, on the lawn of Chemical Abstract Service. Tickets and details at picnicwiththepops.com.
And it's 77 degrees in Columbus, sunny skies, a high of 84, clear skies tonight, a low of 59. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
My guest is Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. And Hal, you're on the air. Thanks for waiting.
Hi there. Thank you. You mentioned anger, Ken, and I'm watching this whole thing from a macro perspective. I think it's designed, the anger part, for micro purposes. And my take on this is that it's to take the focus off of what the working class and middle class America is losing in this kind of contraction and transition into a different economy. And both of these parties are using the same method of anger to keep people from focusing on the loss of so many different things, from defined pensions going back clear into the 70s to the mortgage crisis that we're having now.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of that. I think, you know, you could say that a lot of what they're doing is really about fiscal responsibility and, you know, balancing the budget. But I think a lot of it is also there's an ideological crusade going on that that is clear that, you know, if you stand up to the unions, if you I don't know why teachers, for example, have become a dirty word in this country. I don't understand why that education is suffering, you know, is being hit. When you look at the state budgets, why that's happening as much. So it is one thing to have the anger and one thing to have that, you know, government is out of control, but you're absolutely right. Look who it's affecting. And that's just, you know, and I fear that we're not going to realize what's happened until it's too late.
Thank you, Al, for that question. And Susan from Hilliard, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you. My question is, what is the significance of states' rights? I know the Republicans seem to favor it. The Democrats usually aren't as enthusiastic. And I just never understood the total significance of that. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Well, when Strom Thurmond ran for president in 1948, he ran on the states' rights party, which basically meant that they didn't want any – I mean, states' rights always had the connotation about race and civil rights. George Wallace was always – when he ran for president in 1968, always talked about states' rights. So it did have a connotation about race, but the constitutional – folks, it's also about limited government and small government, and that there should not be – one of the objections to the Obama health care plan was that, as Mitt Romney said, look, what we did in Massachusetts was good, but it was not supposed to be a one-size-fits-all. These are people who don't believe in a one-size-fits-all thing that should be state by state, whether it's abortion, whether it's same-sex marriage, whether it's tax cuts, whether it's, you know, anything. It should be done at the state level. And so that's what's – the history of the states' rights language and the movement is race-related, but it's still about – really what it is about now is limited government versus, you know, the democratic view of just a nation, you know, a strong federal government, which will include health care. Because, you know, you could talk about states' rights all you want, but if people are suffering,
then the federal government, this is the argument, is that the federal government should step in, and that's the obverse argument to states' rights. I don't know if that was clear or not, but that's my understanding of it.
Congressional and legislative district maps are redrawn every 10 years to reflect the population shifts in states. Doesn't bode well for Ohio this time.
Wait. Because they lose. The
state. Right.
Okay.
Who wants to lose?
Yeah, no, that's true.
Let's see. That's not good. Particularly if you have a populous state like Ohio.
But it's losing population, right?
Right, in certain places. How states manage that process often is interesting. How are they doing so far, Ken?
Well, it's all over the map, literally, because it's usually a very political process. In other words, if you're a Democrat, a governor, and the Democrats control the legislature, look out, Republicans are in big trouble. That's the case in Illinois, where Republicans gained so many seats in 2010, but because Democrats control the process in Illinois, Republicans wind up losing six seats. They can redraw the lines to make two Republicans run against each other, or they can make a Republican district more Democratic with more Democratic votes in there, or they could put them in a Democratic district to run against a Democratic incumbent. And the Republicans control the process in states like Pennsylvania and Ohio and Indiana and Michigan, where you have a Republican governor, a Republican state legislature, and it's the Democrats who are in trouble. Now, you also have states like California, which is the voters passed in 2010 a nonpartisan commission that will decide how the lines are drawn. And if you look at California over the last couple of cycles, if not the last two decades, very few incumbents are defeated because Republicans and Democrats draw the lines to protect themselves. But now there's going to be total upheaval in California, even though it won't lose or gain any seats. This is the first time in redistricting history, I think, that California doesn't gain, but the lines will still be redrawn. So there's growing Latino strength in some districts. There's growing Asian strength in some districts. And if that's the case, a lot of incumbents are now very worried about these new voting groups. So it's really, if you love politics, it's fascinating. If you're a partisan, you can be very elated or very discouraged, depending on who's up and who's down. Look at Dennis Kucinich. I mean, Dennis Kucinich is likely to lose his seat in Ohio because of redistricting, and that's why he's talking about maybe running in Washington State, which is one of the more bizarre things I've ever heard. But, there are a lot of bizarre things going on.
You've heard a lot of bizarre things in your day, I'm sure. Well, what about the computerization of this process? Doesn't that help?
Well, help what? I mean, it's still as long as it's still done by state legislators,
which means it's political
and it's partisan, right? Exactly. Right. I mean, yeah, the computer—they're all using computers, but I've seen some districts where they'll draw a line just to exclude the city block where a potential candidate lives, and they said, well, of course, if you live in a state, you can run in any congressional district in the state. You don't have to live in the actual district. But I've seen some maps where they. Just, they're going a straight line and they move to the left or right just to exclude the building where a possible candidate lives just to cause havoc. So it gets kind of silly, but it's been going on for decades. Maybe that's one of the reasons people want it to change.
Now, I might be wrong about this, but my recollection is Ohio pretty much always goes to court.
Well, there are some states that always go to court because of civil rights protections. That's mostly in the South where the Federal Voting Rights Act comes into play, but there'll always be, if the Republicans control everything, I'm almost guaranteeing that the Democrats will take the case to court, and then we'll see battles there too. So that does happen a lot, but ultimately that's why, we always talk about control of Congress, control of the Senate. That's why control of the governorship is also so crucial in matters of politics, especially when it comes to redistricting.
Actually, people can look at a lot of what the Republican-controlled government has done in Ohio and say what they will, but the redistricting process is probably as important as anything.
Absolutely, and that's true around the country. And also, not only that, when Ohio, which went for Obama, loses a congressional seat, that means it also loses an electoral vote. So you'll see that more conservative, more red-leaning states may have more seats in 2012, which means more electoral votes, which is better news or good news for the Republican Party, assuming that the states the red states keep voting Republican, so they'll have more electoral votes.
Delbert in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good evening. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Hey, I've got a question I want to ask, because I don't understand. Like, we got, like, yesterday you had the big parade downtown with the police officers
for
the, and everybody.
For the Senate Bill 5, yeah.
Yeah, for the Senate Bill 5. But don't they realize that every time that they vote for a Republican, that that is what they're going to get? I mean, these are people I talked to, police officer who was crying, and he voted, actually voted for them. But the Republicans have been trying to bust the union since Ronald Reagan. So my question is, if you're poor, if you're a union member, or if you're a government or state or federal employee, should you be voting Republican? Or are you voting against your own interests?
Well, you know, I mean, I don't want to generalize, but most poor people, most union folks don't vote Republican. Same time, most small business people who don't like taxes and don't like regulation, they mostly don't vote Democratic. So, I mean, that's always been the case. There are union folks who do vote Republican. A lot of that is on social issues. You always talk about those Reagan Democrats who were Democrats and union guys, but just didn't like what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's a reaction. The people who were very unhappy in 2011 in Ohio were unhappy about the Democrats in 2010. So, you know, we keep seeing these major shifts in public sentiment that, you know, it's not going to change either.
Well, and also, Ken, a lot of the stuff that popped up since November wasn't stuff that was necessarily what they campaigned on.
Well,
so,
there's truth to that, too. There are a lot of people who are saying that the Kasichs and the Scott Walker of Wisconsin, they are doing things that nobody foresaw. But to be honest with you, I mean, Kasich is a strong conservative. Scott Walker was a strong conservative. I think one of the reasons the union spent so much money against Kasich and Walker, because they feared the worst, and they got the worst.
Thanks, Delbert, for that call. One thing we didn't talk about yet about the press conference yesterday was, you know, when he talked about drawing down the troops in Afghanistan, or that wasn't really much yesterday, but how has that been playing since last week?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There are a lot of Republican candidates who feel that, on the one hand, that we're pulling out of Afghanistan too soon and too hastily. And at the same time, these same Republicans are saying that we have no business being in Libya. I'm not sure if there's a contradiction there, but there are some people who say that Republicans are just opposing whatever Obama wants. But, you know, this Afghanistan stuff is very tricky, because unlike Iraq, President Obama was a pro-Afghani interventionist in 2008. He thought that's where the war should be. And the question, I guess, is, you know, now, yes, he's taking out most of the 30,000 that he put in since the surge, but there's still going to be 66,000 troops in Afghanistan come 2012. And I don't know anybody who feels that the war is succeeding. I mean, I don't, you know, there's sometimes where there are good weeks and there are bad weeks, but then you'll see something like the suicide bombing or the attack on that hotel in Kabul,
right.
You know, where they say, if we can't protect, you know, these kind of places which has so much security, how are we going to win over the countryside? And I don't know how you win a war, win the hearts and minds of people who've been living in this, you know, with these chieftains and these tribes for centuries.
Rudy in Mayfield Heights, you wanted to return to the topic of Senate Bill 5. Well, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I love your show, and it's great to hear Mr. Rudin's ideas. I wanted to return to the idea that Republicans are attacking teachers and Republicans are attacking education, and nothing could be further from the truth. What they're saying is collective bargaining is not an effective way to make sure that we ensure education for our students. The focus should be on the students, and conflating the issue of collective bargaining with education or collective bargaining with teachers is completely wrong. It's all about unions, union organizers, and I can't believe that you let that go, Ann.
Well, I mean, a lot of people, that's definitely the supporters of Senate Bill 5, no question about it, Rudy. That's the point they're making, but that's not the way it's come across to a lot of people, I guess, Ken?
But Rudy, no, I'm not making the case. I'm not saying that by trimming collective bargaining rights and hitting the unions, it's an attack on education. I'm not saying that at all. First of all, I think, as Chris Christie proved in New Jersey, there are a lot of special favors that are built into teacher contracts
that they're not paying, for example, for health care that everybody else is paying for. They're paying for a tiny percentage, and anybody who's going through a strong deficit knows that that's just not fair. I mean, everybody has to chip in. We're talking about sacrifice. There's no reason why, you know, they shouldn't pay more for, you know, their health care, for example. But I'm just talking about, if you look at the monies, I'm not talking about the collective bargaining for teachers. I'm talking about the money to education, the cutbacks to the public schools, the cutbacks in funds to the colleges. That's what I'm talking about. When I say the attacks on teachers, I really meant that it seems like education in these budget cuts, money to education seems to be getting the greatest hits. I agree with you on the collective bargaining thing. I am not equating that as an attack on education.
All right. Thank you, Rudy, for that call, and thanks for the nice compliment. We have a message from Sandra on Facebook. She says, my question is regarding the DREAM Act and immigration reform. Obama had promised sweeping changes, but nothing has changed. Is this going to be like the gay marriage? It seems to me that he will try to woo Latinos because we are the largest minority now.
Well, you know, once upon a time, the Republican Party and George W. Bush and the Chamber of Commerce were, you know, all for changing immigration laws to make it easier for people to stay in the country, for a path to citizenship. But there's also a congressional wing of the Republican Party that, you know, seemed to fight it, talking about building walls, building fences, you know, deporting and things like that. At the same time, the DREAM Act, to me, seemed, well, I mean, you can make the argument that it was important. There are some people who felt that it was just blatantly political to win Latino votes, that, you know, to change the rules, like Harry Reid was pushing the DREAM Act because there's a large Latino population in Nevada. I don't think the DREAM Act is on anybody's priority list. I certainly don't think that with a Republican House and a potential Republican Senate in 2012, that's going to pass anytime soon. But it's clear that since Prop 187 in California in 1994 and Governor Pete Wilson's role in it, Latino community has moved overwhelmingly to the Democratic side, even though you've had people like George W. Bush and John McCain, the old John McCain, I should say, who fought for, you know, look, if I were a Republican and if I was looking at the demographics of this country, I would say the way to keep or to maintain or get a Republican majority is to curry favor with Latino voters, to push policies that helps Latinos, because that is the future. So, you know, right now, some Republicans seem to understand that. Other Republicans feel that, you know, well, we'll just keep doing what we're doing until we can't do it anymore.
Ken Rudin, we have just a minute left. It's your pick. You want to talk about the sculpture of Ronald Reagan going up in Hungary's capital, or do you want to talk about former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich?
I always get those two mixed up. But, you know, I like to talk about Blagojevich because it's very rare when you have an Illinois governor in prison. No, that's not true. Do you know they've had four governors sent to prison since the 1960s?
I've been reminded of that recently,
which is pretty remarkable. And you know, you talk about, Blagojevich, it's just like with Anthony Weiner, you know, it's not so much that he's a Democrat, it's just that he's just a crook, and he was a crook, everybody knew it, and yet they just watched him happen. But it was so interesting how the government tried so hard and failed last year, and they made the case much simpler, and Blagojevich is going to prison for a long time. I said on the air, I don't know if you heard this, but I said that, you know, he may get 300 years in prison, but his attorneys are hoping to cut that sentence in half.
Thank you, Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie. Ken, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Ann. A lot of fun.
Thanks for listening. This is All Sides on WOSU 89.7. This is WOSU HD1 and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org 89.7. NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media. Thank you.